This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the U.S. House of Representatives formally presents an article of impeachment to the Senate accusing former President Donald Trump of inciting the storming of the Capitol. The U.S. Department of Justice opens a probe into whether its officials engaged in an improper attempt to alter the presidential election outcome. And the new U.S. government approves all transactions involving Yemen's Ansarullah for 1 month after the Trump administration designated the movement as a terrorist organization. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The U.S. House of Representatives has formally presented an article of impeachment to the Senate accusing former President Donald Trump of inciting the storming of the Capitol earlier this month. The Senate impeachment trial is the second of Trump and the first ever of a former president. The upper chamber of Congress is expected to start the trial proceeding on February 9th. Democrats are narrowly in control of the Senate, but at least two-thirds of the 100-member body is required to convict Trump. If convicted, a separate vote will be required to block Trump from seeking office again. That vote would only need a simple majority to get passed. A number of Republicans have questioned the constitutionality of the impeachment. Trump is also expected to challenge the trial in Supreme Court if convicted. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. So, Colin, if you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this. It's the first time that a president in the United States is being impeached twice, and what are the different possibilities? How could all of this end?
Well, if the president is convicted by the Senate, which is unlikely to happen, you would need a two-thirds vote in the Senate to lead to a conviction. What happens first is the articles of impeachment are generated in the House. And we have to remember that our Congress is bicameral, meaning you have two entities. You have the House of Representatives, and then you have the Senate. So the articles of impeachment started in the House of Representatives. That's where we are for inciting an insurrection. That's what the article of impeachment was rendered as. Now it moves to the Senate, which was delivered today. What happens then is the Senate sets up a trial, and the Senate would then have to vote a two-thirds vote to convict the president, and that could lead to an actual crime if he's convicted of it. The problem is, with hopeful Democrats, I guess, is that the Senate would not vote two-thirds. It's unlikely that it would because of the number of Republicans that are in the Senate. But what Democrats would like to happen is the prevention of the president from running for office ever again. They also would like this to be a record of note, meaning that if a president is accused of inciting an insurrection, there must be a punishment. Many believe that even though the president wouldn't be convicted of a crime, so to speak here, at least it shows that there are limits to what a president can do or can say before they are charged or at least accused of a crime. And the president, in this case, has been impeached twice because the first time dealt with a relationship with Russia, collusion. This one deals with inciting an insurrection.
So, Colin, it seems that Donald Trump definitely has put the spotlight on the limitations to what an a president, a sitting president, can do in the United States. Do you think there will be more discussions? We will be seeing more discussions about that?
There will, but it would come to another conclusion, meaning there are going to be some discussions over whether or not the president had legal dealings when he was president of the United States. People will be looking at his tax records, his financial accounts, and looking as to whether or not the president was being or acting legally during his time as president. That will most likely not lead to another impeachment, but rather, if a former president is above the law, usually there's a status of deference given to a former president where they're not prosecuted, the law isn't really after them. But I think with President Trump, there will be a difference here because of the level of obfuscation that the president engaged in while being president, where we didn't really know a lot of transparency dealing with his presidency. Well, now that he's not president, and there are all these other entities that are looking to see if he engaged in a level of criminality, we're going to see whether or not a former president is indeed above the law. Now, I'm not saying that the president could go to jail. I think it's still too early to tell something like that. But at the very least, he will be investigated and prosecuted.
So thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Colin Campbell, live from Washington, D.C. But to continue that discussion, we have a criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer, Jack Rice, who's joining us from Minneapolis. Mr. Rice, if you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this impeachment trial, and do you believe that Donald Trump would be convicted?
Well, I think the first thing to remember here is that impeachment is not a criminal investigation. It's not a criminal prosecution either. It is a political decision made by the sitting members of Congress. And so the way it works is that the House has to determine by a simple majority, in other words, just over half, that the president, the sitting president, has done something wrong or something worthy of impeachment. They then take that decision to the Senate. The problem, as your correspondent just put it very, very succinctly, is that what you need is a two-thirds majority in order to, if you will, make the finding, to convict, if you will. The problem that we have here is that we have a 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate, Democrats to Republicans, with Vice President Harris actually making the deciding vote. But you still need 16 or 17 other Republicans to come along for the vote. The problem, of course, is, as I said at the beginning, this is a very political question. So the likelihood that Republicans would actually vote to convict this president, which is astounding to me in many ways, but the likelihood is almost nil, almost unlikely at best. In fact, I can almost guarantee that there will be not enough U.S. senators to convict this sitting president, although he's now finished with office.
Now, for us outside the U.S., what you just said is really scary because we did hear the articles of impeachment and what the House referred to as proof of why Donald Trump should be held accountable and how he incited all of this. And knowing that all of this could be political and that there are people who would still support Donald Trump is very scary.
You know, it's a great point that you make, because if we actually sit back and if we could peel the politics out of this, peel the Democrats, peel the Republicans away, and recognize what it is that Donald Trump did. Objectively, what we can say, and this is based upon more than 60 lawsuits filed by this president and his supporters, and each and every one was dismissed out of hand as insufficient. He was lying to the American people about the stealing of this election. And he beat that drum again and again and again. And despite the fact that he was supporting the Boogaloo Boys, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, these are all nationalist racist groups, knowing that they were violent. The fact that he was continuing to support them and to beat this drum and then invited all of them to Washington, D.C. when Congress was making this decision for the certification of President Biden. And then, this was when it was happening, he then says, I want you to go to the Capitol and get tough. Those are his words. And he sends them to the Capitol. And then, after it's over, while this is going on, he then tweets out that this is what happens when you steal an election. It's an extraordinary thing, because if we think about what the standard should be for impeachment, and just for people around the world, the standard is high crimes and misdemeanors. In other words, any crime that you commit could be sufficient to have you removed from office. This was actually a president who purposely brought people to Washington, sent them to the Capitol to try to drive Congress to do something that they didn't want to do. And the idea that that isn't sufficient to actually remove a sitting president is an astounding and, I think, politically frightening concept for Americans if you can pull the politics out of it.
And for all of us outside the U.S. also, Mr. Rice, because the U.S. has been promoting itself as a beacon of democracy, and knowing that democracy has no say in all of this is...
I so agree with you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I've spent a lot of time in Iraq, in Afghanistan, throughout the Middle East, South America, all over Africa, and these are all issues in Russia and elsewhere in the world. And the United States has constantly stood up and talked about being the beacon of democracy. And when something like this happens, I think the rest of the world is watching this and saying, you know what? It feels very hypocritical to watch this now from the United States while they were talking about all these things that they did. I didn't even mention what the U.S. was doing in Iran in the 1950s. So, I mean, we could go down a completely different path.
Thank you very much for your comments, Mr. Jack Rice, criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer, live from Minneapolis. Moving on, the U.S. Justice Department has launched an investigation into whether its officials improperly sought to help former President Donald Trump overturn the election results. The announcement came after reports emerged suggesting that the acting assistant attorney general for the civil division had plotted with Trump in a failed bid to oust then-Attorney General Jeff Rosen. The plot was aimed at launching a probe into alleged voter fraud in Georgia. Trump refused to concede defeat in 2020, with his campaign and other Republican allies claiming the vote was rigged in favor of Democrat Joe Biden. In the meantime, the Dominion voting system has filed $1.3 billion defamation suit against Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, for spreading lies about a widespread election fraud. The new U.S. government has approved all transactions involving Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the next month. The move comes just a week after the previous administration designated Ansarullah as a terrorist organization, sparking an international outcry. The Treasury Department has said foreign banks would not be exposed to sanctions if they knowingly conduct or facilitate a transaction for the Yemeni movement. Many aid groups and international organizations have demanded the U.S. revoke the decision, saying the move would put millions of lives at risk. The United States is already facing criticism for its military support of the Saudi-led coalition that launched a devastating war on Yemen back in 2015. Yemenis have also protested the recent U.S. move against Ansarullah and its backing of the Saudi regime for its war crimes.
On the Global Day of Action for Yemen, Yemenis from all walks of life took the streets in the capital Sana'a and other major cities to denounce the U.S. terrorist designation of the Ansarullah movement. The demonstrators voiced their support for the Ansarullah movement and called on U.S. administration to reverse the decision.
The demonstration comes as a reaction to 6 years of killing, blockade and targeting of Yemen with barges, planes and missiles. People here are against the U.S. move, viewing it as a meddling in their internal affairs.
The Yemeni people came out to send this clear message that they will not sit back against the growing pressure. They rallied to denounce the U.S. policies and hold it accountable for most of the pressure imposed on them over the past years.
Demonstrators also confirmed that the Ansarullah movement is an inseparable part of Yemen and they are determined to defend Yemen against the Saudi-led coalition's war. Earlier, over 170 Yemeni NGOs condemned U.S. terrorist designation of Ansarullah.
U.S. served as the main source of terrorism in the world. It is a great Satan. America is the main sponsor of Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and all attack-wheel groups in the region.
Yemenis will survive the unjust pressure imposed on them. They will not give up resistance and will continue to fight for their independence and dignity.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering from war and siege imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition, during which war crimes were committed and international humanitarian law was violated by killing thousands of women and children.
Yemenis say the U.S. decision is not against a specific group, but rather against a nation severely suffering from war and the blockade imposed by Washington's allies in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Moving on, senior EU officials contact their counterparts in the new U.S. administration to discuss plans to try and preserve the Iran nuclear deal. Experts say there will be big economic benefits if the 2015 accord is put back on track. Jerome Hughes reports.
They are clearly very different issues, but EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed the two main policy areas on which they want to make progress with the United States are climate change and the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The ministers have just concluded face-to-face talks on the subjects in Brussels.
From climate change to Iran and JCPOA, and the most important ones, the most urgent ones, and the ministers are ready for a new start.
That new start is necessary because of Donald Trump's hate-fueled anti-Iran campaign during the past 4 years. The former U.S. president pulled Washington out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions designed to try and cripple Iran's economy. Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say U.S. banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business. There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the US will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that US sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now in Lebanon, protesters are angry over coronavirus-related lockdown measures and they've clashed with police in the northern city of Tripoli. Prior tear gas dispersed to protesters who said the government's measures are exacerbating poverty in the country. Lebanon is trying to curb a dramatic rise in coronavirus cases that has brought its medical system to its knees. The country is also in the midst of an economic crisis. With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My country, Iran, is a vast land with four seasons. The four-season feature in Iran brings about the experience of winter tourism in one place and summer tourism in another at the same time. For example, rain, wavy seas, storm, beautiful rivers, desert, all and all are available in just one land. Today we are going to visit northwest of Iran to see one of the wonders of this region, the Takht-e-Suleyman Lake of Takab. Takht-e-Suleyman, meaning Throne of Solomon, is an archaeological site in West Azerbaijan province, which used to be known as Ganjak very long time ago. Today this region is called Takht-e-Suleyman. Takht-e-Suleyman site is 45 kilometers northeast of the city of Takab. The ancient area of Takht-e-Suleyman includes Sassanid and Ilkhanid gates, Azargoshasp fire temple, and Anahita temple. At the center of this archaeological site, there is a lake which is actually the beating heart of this historical complex. The Takht-e-Suleyman Lake is a calcium-rich spring with thousands of years of age, which outflows water rigorously from the deep underground water. The water, which boils at a depth of more than 120 meters, is saturated with minerals so that it cannot be used for drinking or farming. I am now in the area of Takht-e-Suleyman. It's really cold in here. I'd better wear my gloves. There is snow everywhere, and the scenery is really fascinating. I have to walk further to reach the lake. spectacular. The amount of minerals in the lake is so much, so it is not possible to dive or even see through the depth of the lake. That is why they say there is secrets about this lake. And there are also local legends. There is a story which says, one Solomon struck his stick to the ground, and a spring started flowing and created the lake, which today is called Taht-e-Suleiman. And here there is a notice. Oh, well, I'm not wearing my glasses, so I have to get close to see what's written. It reads, no swimming. Of course, no one ever swims in such a freezing weather. Oh, well, what's this? Oh, God. It's a gravestone. This grave belongs to a person who has gone swimming in the lake and drowned. In this season, which sunlight reflects off the snow, steam rises off the lake. It's a really mysterious and enchanting scenery. I can't take my eyes off of these beauties. I'd like to stand here forever and stare at this foggy lake. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints and Analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaykum assalam. Thank you for having me here.
So, in this series of the program Viewpoints produced by Brother Mahmoud, we are dedicating our discussions to some of the most important speeches of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei regarding different occasions. And since these days, especially in the month of Bahman, which is the 11th month according to the solar calendar in Islamic Republic of Iran, a very big event took place about 42 years ago. And that was the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which we can say led to the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran, founded by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. There are so many discussions regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran and Islamic Revolution. Of course, this revolution is a rough translation for what happened as Inqilab in Iran, because usually revolution has a negative connotation, but this Inqilab was a change, a political change, social change, religious change inside Iran, and now we know it, this country all across the world, the United Nations, by the name Islamic Republic of Iran, or the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay, Said Mohsen Naqvi, first of all, let's get to the main sources for this revolution. Now, here and there, everybody knows that the thoughts of Imam Khomeini had direct role in establishing such an authority. Maybe some people think that it started in 1978 and then took place in 1979. But Imam Khomeini's movement had started very much earlier. And if we want to talk about his ideology, Imam Khomeini's ideology in establishing a government and a state for Iran, how do you define it for us, and how do you give us a picture of his ideology?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Imam Khomeini was a man of Islam, and he was truly a follower of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam. The main ideology behind the Islamic State of Iran, or Islamic Republic of Iran, we can say, like this revolution that happened, was to apply the Muhammadan Islam in the society. There are many societies, there were many Muslim countries, but they all were lacking Muhammadan Islam, the true Islam that was there. And although we can see, like Raza Shah, who has a Muslim name, who looks like a Muslim, but obviously the rules that were obviously that were applied in this country, in this state, were non-Islamic. Obviously, he banned the hijab. His father banned the hijab.
That's right.
And
known as Kashf-e hijab in Iran.
Kashf-e hijab.
That's right.
Known as Kashf-e hijab.
Okay.
And obviously, alcohol was allowed.
Mm-hmm.
There were no security for the people. People couldn't have their religious, we can say, like
gatherings. That's right.
Freely. So there was no freedom of, we can say, like religion
mm-hmm.
within this country that was known as an Islamic country, like
okay.
Iran. So the main aim was to give this freedom, the religious freedom, to the people, and give the security to them, like when they're performing this.
Okay.
And in order to do that, obviously, we have to go back towards the actual Islam, the Muhammadan Islam. We need to follow Quran.
That's right.
So the main basis of this revolution was to basically to bring back the Quran and the Sirah, or the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
That's right.
In the Islamic State.
But the main question is that we can say maybe when we say Islamic, some people believe that it must be 100% Islamic. I mean, if you look at, for example, a society. It must be all the Islamic laws are observed, or no, it is very difficult. I mean,
well,
acting according to the Sharia of Islam,
yes,
is very difficult, even in our personal lives, let alone to the
you
social
know,
arena.
When I did not came to Iran, we used to think like there is no stealing in Iran, no one steals anything,
okay.
There is no robbery, nothing.
Okay.
So we used to look the Islamic Republic of Iran like this. But obviously we need to remember that the Islamic rules are there by the governments,
mm-hmm.
by the leader, by, for example, the Wali al-Faqih.
That's right.
Or the, we can say, like the assembly. They bring all the rules.
Yes.
But do the people follow them or not, they're free.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one like behind you who has the hunter, for example.
Hunter game. There is no
yeah.
hunter game.
I think, Sid, you could actually have another imagination about the Islamic Republic, because at the time that
even
Holy Prophet
yes,
was managing his
prophet,
own government,
people were
weren't you expecting anyone, for example, to steal
yes.
something, or on whom was the hudud were actually implementing?
Okay.
It means that even at the time of the Holy Prophet, while he was the actually creator of this foundation, In his own government, he performed hudud and he did qasas, and
they were hypocrites.
They were hypocrites. So we should not expect such a thing even from the Islamic Republic.
I know,
though
generally,
it is good to have it in
yes,
our
the way
plans,
brother,
inshallah, to
yeah.
reach that.
The way Brother Atta has said, like people think like 100% there should be everything Islamic, nothing should be wrong.
Do you know why I
asked? I think it's good to even
it's in the people's because
you know?
because when you're establishing a political system based on Islamic Sharia, it will be very difficult to run it, especially in the 21st century.
I think this is one of the
21st century. Uh-huh. Because, you know, what is known is that, as I told you, on that time, liberal capitalism was active from one side, the communism was active, and in both these systems, you do not see any religion or any religious type of thinking, okay? They absolutely believe in the separation from the, we can say, the church and the state or mosque and the state, okay? So what I say is that when you are running a society and a country according to Islamic Sharia, it will be very much difficult. And at the same time, updating the Islamic Sharia based on the needs of the day is very important. This is what Imam Khomeini was after because... you know,
even there are lots of things to be said, even in this very point that you mentioned, in this word updating, updating up to how much updating? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, does it mean changing the rules?
No,
or?
There are some limits within the limits, you need to bring reform.
What were the main values the people were after on following the maktab of Imam Khomeini, Brother Ali? There must be some values. We know that when you look at the Pahlavi regime in Iran at that time. The universities, the, we can say, road-making, industry, economy, political scene, having international relations with the other countries, okay? These were all there and now are available too. But Imam Khomeini somehow introduced some new concepts and values to the society. What were those values?
Before going to your question, I'd like to comment on the previous point that you have been talking about with respected Sayyid, and that was I wanted to answer the question that you were talking about with a comment by the leader, the current leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Khamenei. Once he was asked that, are you leading an Islamic community? Are you leading an Islamic country? And are you trying your best to implement Islamic laws? Mm-hmm. And can you claim that this country that you are actually leading is an Islamic country? The leader replied, I think it was a young guy that he was answered by the leader that, look, we are trying to bring all the Islamic rules. We are on the way to make it perfect, but there are lots of obstacles on the way. We don't claim that we are a fully Islamic country at the moment, but we are trying our best to reach to that point to become an Islamic state. Mm-hmm. So claiming a country or a community to be Islamic is not an easy thing, brother, because there are lots of things that needs to come together and actually find a sort of convergence to make it Islamic. Even as I mentioned and actually said to the brother, even at the time of the Prophet, Muslims wanted to live Islamically. But there were some that who were against and hypocrites who were making obstacles on the way of Muslims, on the way of performance of Islamic laws. So in the course of history, we found these issues, and even for today, we want to actually implement all the Islamic and religious laws in our country. Mm-hmm. But the issues and events that comes to us, like, for example, 8 years of That's imposed right. war, then later sanctions, and different issues, they target this Islamic and new and young tree of the Islam.
We know that at the first 3 years of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, civil wars took place in the streets of Iran. And the system, had fought different groups.
Yeah.
We have missed so many of our ulama and our thinkers at the very beginning in assassinations and in bomb explosions. And these are, vandalisms that took place. After that, we got 8-year war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. And these were all at the very beginning. As you said, this political system was very young, mm-hmm. was a teenage maybe. Very okay, true. And all these events took place.
Yeah, back to your question concerning what
the values
that actually were lacked by the previous regime and were seen in this current government as in the new mm-hmm. governments after the revolution. I can actually enlist some of the values that, inshallah, we can actually discuss them later in depth. One was the people's vote and, let's say, public authorities public authority were not seen in the, let's say, outcome of the government.
That's right.
There were some elections. I don't want to say that there was no election at all, but these elections were limited and, let's say, special people could enter. Not like today. Like now we see that a person from a far village in one far part of Iran can nominate for the, let's say, for the parliament,
election.
For the parliament, or parliament. Even for the even presidential election.
If he has got higher studies,
if
yes.
he has, okay. I mean, the requirements of that. Mm-hmm. So it, we couldn't see such things at the time of I mean, the Shahs or kings before
the
revolution. The
monarchy system.
So the people's votes were not seen to mm-hmm. that level. We have witnessed and we have even to some extent sensed these things at the time of these two kings and specifically at the time of last two kings. Second was the religious beliefs of the people mm-hmm. were not actually taken into
respected.
Account and were not respected. Mm-hmm. I remember that sometimes people, in order to make a congregation and an assembly for the Azaa, for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were trying to hide it in from different parts in order to enter the place. So it was a part of their religion, and majority of the people were the same. I mean, were having the same beliefs. So how come in a country of, for example, at that time, 95% of Shias were not free to actually pay attention or to work on their own Islamic or religious
okay.
beliefs? So they had such limitations. For ladies and women, while entering, I mean, offices and official places and also mm-hmm. and even the schools for the girls and youngsters, they were actually banned to enter such places with full Islamic hijab and covering. But even on the contrary, they were asked to remove their hijab. So these are the things that when you stand in front of the belief or religion and the habits of a people and a
That's
nation...
Right.
So it will not help you to continue.
Also the social political pressures on the, we can say... artists and also politicians at that time was really high. We know that so many politicians were, we can say, that's right,
very
killed.
True. But in case you ask a person, for example, today, that mm-hmm. To compare the, let's say, the beliefs of the people from before and after revolution, mm-hmm. since we always have a good idea of what has been in the past, we might say that okay, no, at that time people were more religious.
Nostalgia.
I don't want to say that people were not that religious, mm-hmm. but the growth of religious beliefs
yeah,
in
and
our,
rituals
and rituals,
rituals
and spirituality
right.
after revolution cannot be compared to
That's
whatever
right.
we have.
And this
we
is
have
natural because
the
system
before
is,
revolution.
Yeah, okay. That's all right in comparison to the past. This is not only limited to Iran, all around the world.
Yeah.
The people have the nostalgia, you know,
yeah.
this nostalgic feeling of the past was better,
yeah.
and now the present is better. But now the present will
and
be
one
the
good
past
sample
for the
of
future.
It, brother, one good sample and example of it is the imposed war. We have seen that
yes.
the growth of this spirituality
yeah.
made those youngsters to go to the battlefronts and actually
okay.
sacrifice themselves
okay.
for the nation and for the Islam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Ali and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi for presence in the program Viewpoints. We'll get to some of the most important mottos and slogans of the Islamic Revolution of Iran as preached by Imam Khomeini in an upcoming session of the program. Dear listeners, visit our website, parstree.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Afiya Manallah.
قام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت مرايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسودا تلبي الخمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Starting under Obama and continuing under Trump, the U.S. has been heavily involved in the war on Yemen, primarily through weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. These weapons are by and large used to intentionally target and kill Yemenis. The reality is the harrowing situation in Yemen can be directly traced back to Raytheon and other weapons manufacturers' influence on U.S. foreign policy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Christina M. Panzica Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Yemen Crisis Linked to Weapons Maker Raytheon's Influence on U.S. Foreign Policy. Here's the second part of this article. In October 2016, news broke of Saudi Arabia striking a funeral procession in Sana'a, killing at least 140 people and injuring 500. In a largely symbolic move, the Obama administration blocked the delivery of Raytheon bomb parts that were sold but not yet shipped, citing concerns regarding Saudi Arabia's poor targeting. Raytheon's then-chief executive officer, Thomas Kennedy, personally called and lobbied Tony Blinken, the Deputy Secretary of State, and also reached out to Secretary of State John Kerry and National Security Advisor Susan Rice to express his discontent with Obama's move. While the shipment of those specific weapons was momentarily stopped, Obama continued aircraft refueling and increased intelligence sharing with Saudi Arabia. After the election of Trump, Raytheon continued to exert influence on U.S. policy. The company's first order of business was arranging several meetings between Thomas Kennedy and Trump, including during Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia in May 2017. Soon after, Trump approved the shipment of the weapons that Obama blocked. It certainly did not hurt that Raytheon had allies already embedded throughout the Washington bureaucracy. For example, the company's former chief lobbyist, Mark Esper, became Secretary of the Army and eventually Secretary of Defense from July 2019 to November 2020. During his confirmation, Esper refused to rescue himself from decisions affecting Raytheon. In addition, Acting Assistant Secretary of State Charles Faulkner had previously lobbied on defense procurement issues on behalf of Raytheon. He was eventually removed from his post for his integral role in fast-tracking $8 billion in Raytheon arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Raytheon, like other defense contractors, also employs other tactics to influence U.S. policy. One method includes hiring former State Department officials to lobby their former colleagues in the department to approve the sales Obama had blocked. These officials are not required to register as lobbyists. In its quest to guarantee Trump's approval of the weapons sales that Obama had halted, Raytheon also solicited support from lobbyist David J. Urban, who was in the same class at West Point with Mark Esper and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They maintain strong ties and affectionately refer to themselves as West Point Mafia. Raytheon and other defense contractors also hire lobbying firms on a retainer basis to monitor legislation and step in if necessary. The two largest defense industry lobbying firms are American Defense International, ADI, and McKeon Group. McKeon Group represents not only a large percentage of the arms industry, but also the government of Saudi Arabia. McKeon Group was founded by Buck McKeon, a former House representative from California's 25th Congressional District, who served on the Armed Services Committee from 1991 until 2014. His largest campaign donors and current clients are Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, two of the largest defense contractors in the world. Simultaneously, McKeon Group lobbies on behalf of the government of Saudi Arabia, working to kill bills that would impact U.S. arms sales. Both companies, ADI and McKeon Group, have been integral to setting U.S. policy regarding Yemen. In November 2018, 2 weeks before a vote was to be held regarding the bill that would end U.S. involvement in Yemen, the McKeon Group contacted Senator Jim Inhofe, chair of the Armed Services Committee, on behalf of Saudi Arabia. Inhofe then voted in favor of continuing U.S. support of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. And the very next day, the McKeon Group donated $1,000 to the senator. Foreign Agents Registration Act records show that the company made several phone calls and sent multiple emails to a host of other members of the Senate and House regarding the bill. These lobbying companies work tirelessly to safeguard their clients' interests no matter who is in office. What's more, the countless lobbyists and officers from these companies in unelected government positions give the weapons industry a direct hand in governing and creating policy. Raytheon claims that it does not set policy but merely complies with it is immediately discredited upon examination of this web of influence within and upon the government. Because of growing public outrage at the atrocities being committed in Yemen, Raytheon and all weapons manufacturers have had to find ways to continue to rationalize their bloodstained fortunes. Given that arms manufacturers are intertwined with the U.S. government, we should remain skeptical of Biden's promise to end the war in Yemen. As demonstrated by the Obama and Trump administrations, the role of U.S. presence is to pursue a foreign policy that in large part protects and upholds the interests of the U.S. elite, including U.S. arms manufacturers. To perform this duty, Trump and Obama appointed top Raytheon executives, while members of Congress carefully heeded their guidance delivered by ADI and the McCune Group. Biden is no exception to this trend, evidenced by his nomination of Lloyd Austin. The U.S. government is a government of, by, and for corporations. The leaders of multinational corporations move continuously from industry to government and back again. The corporatocracy is often characterized by the proverbial revolving door, but in some instances, there is no door. Distinctions melt away, and corporations and government become one. Corporations like Raytheon do not, as they claim, follow U.S. foreign policy. They make it. Thus, the question at hand is not about forcing government officials to divest from any stake they have in companies they previously worked for. Nominally, cutting off ties does not indicate a divergence in interest. The U.S. government, by design, works to serve the interests of the billionaires, not the majority of the people who live paycheck to paycheck, and definitely not to bring freedom to the millions who face their bombs and boots. In order to bring an end to the genocidal war in Yemen, Americans must reckon with and fiercely oppose this reality. As people living in the U.S., Americans have a responsibility to stand up against what the U.S. government and corporations do abroad in their name. The Global Day of Action against the war in Yemen on January 25th is just one part of this. Hundreds of anti-war Yemeni and humanitarian organizations from across the world are coming together to call for an end to the genocidal war in Yemen days after Biden's inauguration and the day before Saudi Arabia's Davos in Desert Forum, where the Saudi Crown Prince will promote foreign investment in Saudi Arabia. Protests are planned across the country and the world, and an online event is being held for those who can't attend an in-person protest.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.